Good morning, members. The coffee is hot. And welcome. We're going to be talking about a possible walk-in program. What a funding would look like, because there seems to be substantial differences of opinion, and it's a good, always when there's substantial differences of opinion, to have some discussion. And so we're going to start by asking our council just to talk about the statutes under which the Game and Fish Fund operates, because that has been discussed as one of the potential funding sources of a walk-in program, and some people are assuming that that is what will eventually happen, but we all don't know that yet. So with that, Council, would you want to help us out here?
Sure, Madam Chair, members. You should have received a copy of the statute, Section 97A.055. And this is the statute that establishes the Game and Fish Fund. And you'll notice right away that, unlike some of the other funds that we deal with, like the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, and, you know, the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund, it doesn't have a single source of revenue, and it doesn't have a very clear and stated purpose for the funds. In fact, it receives its revenues from a number of different things. One of the main things are the Game and Fish license fee revenues. It also receives revenues from fines. There's also a number of accounts that have been established within the fund, and some of those accounts have very clear and stated purposes, such as the Wild Rice Management account and the Wildlife Acquisition account. It also receives the federal funds for game and fish activities. And if you look through the statute, you'll see they're listed there in subdivision 2, but this is not a comprehensive list. It's sort of including. But because a lot of these, a lot of the revenues are from user fees, you also see like some of the stamp funds, like the trout and pheasant stamp, the new walleye stamp, that there is a lot of interest similar to the new legacy funds. So Citizen Oversight Committee was established, and many of you may have seen the Game and Fish Fund report that's put out that sort of looks at the fund a lot in more detail than we would maybe other ones, because it is such a heavily driven by user fees. So I just wanted to put this in the in members' packet so you had it. Unfortunately, it's not going to be as clear-cut as some of our other funds, so we don't know, you know, it's not as easy and clear to see where the funds are coming from and what the purposes can be used for, but I wanted to put that in front of you. So hopefully that's what members were looking for.
Thank you. Questions for council at this point? There's certainly maybe questions later on, but that's a good start. Mr. Reinholz, did you want to comment at this point? Or do you want to wait until after the presentation?
Madam Chair, it's what you would wish to either hear or that. It might be best to hear from the department, get an understanding of the Game and Fish Fund, and then we'll come back to the funding of the a proposed walk-in program.
I think so. Let's do it that way. So with that, we will ask folks from DNR to give us an overview of the Game and Fish Fund, and I see we have something in our packet right now, or a handout from DNR. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Pete Squirra, Administrative Services Chief for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And we'd like to quickly go through some background on the Game and Fish Fund, expanding a little bit on what Ms. Taylor just talked about in terms of what it consists of, talk about the health of the fund in terms of expenditures and revenues and account balances, and then talk about the purposes and outcomes of the fund. And we're going to specifically focus on small game surcharge. That was a question we know that the chair had. That's a fund that's dedicated to wildlife management area acquisition and development. So we'll try to do this in 15 minutes or so, and then stand for any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pete Score, Administrative Chief for DNR Fish and Wildlife. We're going to give a brief description, as council mentioned, of the Game and Fish Fund. We have a copy of the Game and Fish Fund report here. You'll see it throughout the document. A lot of this information in the presentation is from here. We've got a fund statement in this document. It's available online. I believe the link online is on your agenda. If anyone else needs that link, we can provide that as well. As council mentioned, the Game and Fish Fund is the depository of Game and Fish Fund licenses. It also has surcharges, set-asides, and other stamp revenue deposited within it. And we'll go later in our presentation and talk about those dedicated accounts, what they can and cannot be used for. It's also the depository of the federal excise tax for the wildlife restoration and the sport fish restoration programs. And that's the federal excise tax on fishing and hunting equipment. In the Game and Fish Fund report is a November forecast. And we have updated those numbers with the February forecast that just came out in early March. The February forecast shows, with current appropriations and current forecasted revenues, it shows that in FY 10 through 14, that expenditures will exceed revenues by approximately $2.6 million, which varies within a little range, but it's within $200,000 to $300,000 per year during that range. The Game and Fish Fund shows a balance of $4.3 million at the end of the FY 12-13 biennium. That's the next upcoming biennial budget that we're preparing for, which is about a 4% of the annual revenues coming into that fund. The last major fee increase was passed 10 years ago. That's including fishing revenues, fishing fee licenses, and hunting license fees. Some small changes have been made, so we stress the word major fee increase. Here it is graphically. We, from fiscal year 0001 biennium, you can see that the receipts were exceeding the expenditures, and as we get into the FY 10-11 and 12-13 biennia, the expenditures will exceed revenues. The yellow line at the bottom is the expected fund forecast balance at the end of the biennium, and you can see it declining through the 06-07 all the way to the 12-13 biennium. The revenues have been supported in the large part in the 0001 to the 0405 biennia with increases or changes in deer licensing buying habits of deer license buyers, and then through the 8-9 biennium and on with the federal excise taxes and the increase in Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson funds. As council mentioned, 97.055 creates both the Game and Fish Fund, but it also creates the Oversight Committee. Now, the Oversight Committee reviews the Game and Fish Fund report, which we have a copy of it here, our latest. It comes out on December 15th of every year. And the Budget Oversight Committee is made up of 9 subcommittees, each with citizen-appointed members by the commissioner. Those 9 subcommittees are listed here. Each appoint a chair, and those chairs sit on a larger budget oversight committee chaired by a non-member of subcommittees that's appointed by the commissioner as well. We've listed the tasks of the budget oversight committee. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but you can review them at your leisure. One of the major roles that they play is review of the Game and Fish Fund report that we put out. They also submit a report on findings based on that report and their findings to their review, and that's due out in June of every year. And they also have some biennial budget review authority in statute as well. One of the issues that the Budget Oversight Committee came up with is the, what we call the allocation of fishing and hunting revenues. The issue is how much revenue is supported by the, or how much expenditures are supported by the associated revenues. When we take a look at fishing-related expenditures, we compare how much revenue is coming in, and we talk about it on a percentage basis. Currently, fishing expenditures represent 112% of its revenue, meaning it's spending more than fishing-related activity brings in. If we were to bring that balance into 100%, it would cost either in reduction of expenditures or increase of revenue of $4.7 million per year. The current hunting revenue is 92%, so the hunting side of the equation is bringing in more revenue than the expenditures. Now, I might add that there is no statutory requirement that this balance is at 100% or lower than 100%. It is a finding of the Budget Oversight Committee that we focus on with our Game and Fish Fund report, with our fiscal notes, with our fee proposals and our expenditure proposals as well. The Budget Oversight Committee has agreed that this situation be fixed or be looked at on a revenue side rather than expenditure side. Here it is graphically. You can see on the top the hunting-related revenues are exceeding in every biennium the expenditures, and on the bottom the fishing-related revenue is lower than the expenditures. I'll turn it over for Ed for explanation of the program.
Okay, just to talk about how the funds are used. The Game and Fish Fund is used throughout the department. It has to be used on game and fishing related activities by law and by both state and federal law. So you can see in this chart the percentages predominantly in fisheries and wildlife management and enforcement within the department, with smaller amounts in other divisions and bureaus within the department. We're going to give some examples of the programs and outcomes. There's more thorough listing in the in this report that that you have the link to online, and it's a very complex budget and program. I'm going to focus on a few of the major programs and outcomes, starting with fisheries. The major functions within fisheries management include population management, habitat management, propagation of fish for stocking through our hatchery system, providing education and outreach to the public, and planning and coordination. Some example outcomes from last fiscal year include 954 lake and stream surveys, 13,800 acres of protected or improved habitat, 250 miles of approved stream bank, 267 lakes with walleyes, et cetera. You can see on the slide. Moving to the wildlife program, this program manages and protects the wildlife management area system in the state, which consists of approximately 1,408 areas, totaling 1.3 million acres. We also provide technical assistance to other agencies, organizations, and landowners, manage more than 50 game species, and provide outdoor recreation to about 580,000 licensed hunters. Similar major functions to what I talked about in fisheries, and moving into example outcomes.
I'm
sorry, Madam Chair.
Ask a question about this providing a lot of assistance to private landowners. When I went over the Game and Fish Fund report last night, didn't read it in total detail, but was surprised, I think, to find how much money was being spent on private lands. Not that I so much object to it, but I was wondering why when we haven't restored our public lands and we have so much outstanding work to be done on our public lands, why we're spending money on private lands before we finish that job.
Madam Chair, we've tried to balance those needs. I'm going to talk more about the needs on public lands later on in the presentation, but we have our public lands at a minimum standard. Obviously, they can be improved, and I know there's great interest in doing that, and we're interested in doing that as well. But we also recognize that our public land base, particularly in the agricultural part of the state, is a very small part of the habitat in that region. So we've seen a need for a multi-pronged approach to work with private landowners, with our sister agencies, with our partners, as well as managing public lands. So we've maintained a focus on public lands, but not to the exclusion of working with private landowners. And we have a handful of staff that work exclusively with private landowners, but all of our field staff, to some extent, do respond to requests for assistance with wildlife planning on private lands, and we think that's an important component. Obviously, it gets into priorities, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation.
Can you give us a percentage of how much of, I mean, is it, that didn't seem to be broken down in here?
Madam Chair, off the top of my head, I don't know what that percentage would be. I'd have to go back and check some numbers and get you that percentage. I'd say, you know, the bulk of our habitat work is on public land, certainly, but I don't know what the percentage is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bogus, I want to probe the question about partners a little bit. So if you've got a private landowner and you've got a local soil and water conservation district person who's paid out of general fund and county revenues, and they go out to meet with the local farmer, is the person from the DNR who's paid out of the Game and Fish Fund riding along with them or talking to them, or do they come out and talk to the farmer a month later not knowing that the soil and water district person has been out there already? I mean, how much cooperation or duplication is there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, or Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, one of our big partnerships in working with private landowners is what we call the Farm Bill Assistance Program with the Board of Water and Soil Resources in Pheasants Forever, where we've helped fund staff in those soil and water conservation districts to work with landowners on Farm Bill programs. The type of technical assistance that our staff are providing are more for private landowners who want to do management plans for their property. It doesn't have the focus of Farm Bill programs, so it's a little bit different type of technical assistance, and our staff are not going along with those soil and water conservation district staff, although we do, our private lands folks do coordinate with those other agencies in terms of trying to improve communications about who's talking to whom, and we're working on a database to track that better and that sort of thing. Continuing on to the examples on wildlife management, you can see them listed there. I won't go through them all, but you can see that actually most of what's listed here for habitat, weed control, prairie grassland plantings, forest land improvements, wetlands, the bulk of that is on public lands or public waters. We do manage some shallow lakes that have been designated for wildlife management purposes that are not on wildlife management areas. Otherwise, most of this work is on wildlife management areas. The population work is obviously statewide type of work on surveys of various species of wildlife, monitor populations, harvests, manage disease, do surveillance for disease, provide for hunts and educational programs. And this is just a sampling of outcomes. As I said, there's more complete listing in the report that you have. Moving on to the Division of Ecological Resources, which also gets some game and fish funding, provided some examples here that relate to the game and fish type functions that are done in that division, including lake vegetation surveys, critical lake habitat, aquatic plant education, stream protection and restoration, aeration permitting. The fish samples and VHS testing did occur in ecological resources in this reporting cycle, but the pathology lab is now in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. But that same work is still continuing with the same funding. And moving on to enforcement, they obviously ensure public safety and compliance with game and fish and other laws. The game and fish type activities that they do are funded with the Game and Fish Fund. So fishing and hunting regulations primarily. Outcome examples there, 7,200 game and fish related warnings, over 5,000 summons, and safety training and clinics for over 25,000 participants. I'd like to focus now a little bit more on just hunting related revenue, because I know that's where some of the questions are, and in particular, Chair Wagenius had asked us about the small game surcharge, which has a focus on wildlife management area acquisition and development. I have to point out to the committee and apologize that this chart that we've provided you, we just realized as we were leaving the office and after the copies had been made that we had an error in this chart. Some revenue from sports and combination licenses had not been included in the small game category. So, Madam Chair, I can get you a corrected chart here, but the slice of the pie there for small game license revenue should be 12% rather than 6%, and that would reduce the deer license percentage to about 60%. So you can see still roughly by this chart that deer license revenue contributes about 60% of the hunting license related revenue, with small game at about 12%. And then the rest of this are all these dedicated accounts that Ms. Taylor referenced in 97A055. There's a variety of stamp accounts, pheasant and duck stamp. Turkey used to be a stamp. Now it's a portion of the license is dedicated to a wild turkey account. Some of the deer licenses have some portions of the license revenue that's dedicated. It's not in addition to the cost of the license, but it's a portion of it that's dedicated, and I'll go into these just quickly in terms of what the dedicated accounts are and where you can find their purposes. I'm not going to go into the detail on these, but other than the wildlife acquisition, what's known as the wildlife acquisition account, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, but that's currently a $6.50 surcharge on all small game licenses. And at least 50% of that account by law must be used for land costs. The rest of it can be used for land acquisition, development, and maintenance of wildlife lands or for waterfowl breeding grounds in Canada. Some of the other dedicated accounts from license revenue, there's $2 from each deer license that goes into a deer management account. That's for deer habitat improvement or deer management programs that was established in the I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
There is a special surcharge on small game, but there's no comparable special charge on deer license. Is that what I'm getting?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's a portion of the license fee is dedicated. Actually, several portions of the deer license fee are dedicated, but there's no special surcharge on deer licenses.
I'm talking about small game is for, I just want to be clear about this, the small game is to buy land or restore land. That is the $6.50 surcharge on small game, right?
Correct, ma'am.
Okay. There is no similar surcharge on deer licenses of $6.50 to do the same thing.
Madam Chair, there's no similar surcharge to do those purposes of any amount.
Why the disparity?
Madam Chair, and I can get into it in a little more detail later, but the surcharge on the small game license has a long history. Back in 1951, the wildlife section of the Department of Conservation at that time started a program called Save the Wetlands, which I'm going to talk about, and that was to acquire primarily wetlands for wildlife areas. It was done with existing license revenue and with Pittman-Robertson federal reimbursements that were coming back. And in 1957, there was a push to establish an account for that purpose by adding a surcharge to small game licenses. So a $1 surcharge was added to small game licenses in 1957. That was doubled in the 70s to $2. It was doubled again to $4 in the, I think, early 80s. I've got a slide on it. And then about 6 years ago, it was increased to $6.50. So that's a long-standing surcharge that all small game hunters have been paying, with the emphasis on acquiring wildlife areas, primarily in the farmland parts of the state. At the time that surcharge started, there were very few deer in the agricultural parts of the state, and it was primarily seen as a benefit to small game hunters. There's just never been a comparable surcharge proposed or adopted for deer hunters, for whatever reason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bogus, just roughly back in the 50s when it was established in the small game license, how many small game hunters did we have?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in those days it ranged between, usually it varied with the grouse cycles and the pheasant populations, but it was probably 350 to 400,000, varied between 300 and 400,000.
Madam Chair, so we were in the height of the baby boom and people were out hunting and it was a different state, and now we've got less than 80,000 small game licenses, so we have fewer people paying more. It's not as broad-based as it was back then.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, we've actually got a lot more small. I think you're thinking of pheasant hunters specifically. Small game license buyers that pay the surcharge ranges still in that 250 to 300,000 range. I don't know if I've got that in front of me. But we could certainly get that number. It is, actually, we have about the same number of total licensed hunters now that we had back then, but we have many more deer hunters. We have, 450,000 deer hunters now, and we didn't have nearly that many deer hunters back in the 50s.
Madam Chair, I think on the sheet, maybe this is wrong then, there's a sheet in our packet, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, historical licenses, privilege code 211, resident small game, numbers sold in 2009, 79,875.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, you'd have to add the individual sports and combination sports and non-resident numbers. That would get you, I think, to the number that I'm referencing.
So resident combination, Madam Chair, resident combination sports is 82,000. Resident individual sports is 96,000. So we'd add 211, 216, 217, and then the non-residents.
Right.
It'd be 221.
Yeah, we're coming up with around 250, but okay, somewhere in that range.
This is a handout from Mr. Reinholz, and he will talk about that.
We do have. I don't think I have it with me, but we do have total small game license sales by year going all the way back. You know, we could provide that if the committee would be interested in it. As well as total licensed hunter numbers. Maybe just to quickly move through, because I'm going to cover some of this a little bit again, but just to quickly move through the rest of the dedicated accounts. There's a dollar from each deer and bear license that goes into a deer and bear management account that was established in the early 1980s when we went to computerized lottery systems for those licenses. And any that isn't needed for running those lottery systems is used for deer and bear management programs. There's an emergency deer feeding and wild servant health account that was established in the mid-1990s after a couple of severe winters as a deer feeding account, and was later after CWD showed up in Wisconsin and in captive servants in Minnesota, was expanded to allow servant health to be an allowable use. The migratory waterfowl stamp is the oldest stamp account that we have. It was started in the 1970s. Moving on to the pheasant stamp account, that was started in the mid-1980s. Again, the purposes of all these accounts are very specific in statute. There are oversight committees that review the expenditures of all of these accounts to assure that they're being used for what they're intended. The turkey used to be a stamp account. That stamp cost has now been rolled into the base license fee, and just a portion of the license fee is dedicated to turkey management, similar to some of the deer accounts. And then I just wanted to talk a little bit about the small game surcharge, which we've already covered some of the points I was going to make, and the wildlife management area system. This chart or pie chart just shows the origin of the wildlife management area lands. You can see that less than half were either acquired or tax forfeit. Actually, a lot of our larger wildlife management areas, things like Carlos Avery, Whitewater, Roseau River, Lac Parle, Thief Lake, were a lot of that land was acquired from counties or federal government or other agencies. That was tax forfeited land that was not on the tax roll. So we're still teasing out the amount that was actually acquired from private landowners. I can't give you that number today, but we move to the next slide.
Before you go on to the next slide.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Of these WMA lands, is there a portion of these lands that are school trust lands?
Madam Chair, yes. Out of the 1.3 million acres, it's around 100,000 acres that's school trust land. And much of that land, Madam Chair, is forested and does earn revenue. But some of it is swamp or peatland, and there's really not a revenue generation that occurs on those lands. But where it's forested, we do habitat management through commercial forestry and the forested WMAs. As the forest habitat needs are identified, we use commercial timber harvest to accomplish that management.
So of this 100,000, is most of it forested? A small portion forested, or?
Madam Chair, I don't know that percentage, but I would say that most of it is forested or forested or wetland.
The reason I ask that is, you know, we are not in an island here when we're talking about these WMAs. The folks on our schools committee are extremely interested in revenues and questioning mightily, to say the least, how much money is going into the school trust fund from revenue from lands that are that you are managing. So when lands are forested, this 100,000 acres in the WMA that's open for hunting, do we, does the Game and Fish Fund put a portion of the money into the school trust to essentially pay rent for use of those lands for hunting?
Madam Chair, no. We, any revenue generated from those lands through timber harvest is, does go to the school trust fund, but there's no rent paid to the trust fund for use of those lands by the public.
How does that meet our fiduciary responsibility? I mean, that's the question that's coming up. I mean, it's not not my question. I haven't brought it up. It's been brought up to me again and again now that something's got to be done with school trust fund lands. And it's good to know what portion it is, 100,000 acres. But I'm just curious why we haven't assumed that we should be putting into the pot some money essentially to pay what I would call rent. Because there are other people out there that are saying, we got to sell these off. Just sell them and take the profit and put it in a school trust, which I don't feel comfortable with at all, but it does bring up the issue.
Madam Chair, I think some sort of user fee for school trust fund lands is a valid question, but that's a policy issue that I think is bigger than the Game and Fish Fund itself. I think it's a valid debate to have, but I don't know why it hasn't been done in the past. Certainly, you know, there are a lot of school trust lands under state ownership that are used by the public for a variety of purposes, and I don't know that there's any sort of a fee that's required to use those lands, but it's a valid question. Why not?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think that is a valid point, the school trust lands, because we're, we may have to revisit that in the future because we need to make those lands pay for themselves. And I'm aware in the area that I came from of a school forest that, I mean, that's where people hunted, other than on their own private lands. And I just wonder if there's 100,000 acres there, and my question then would be, with all the money that we've spent buying lands and everything, do you have a handle on, and I don't have my book with me from the legislative auditor, but do you have a handle on how many acres there are available for people to hunt on DNR purchased property for the state? I mean, do you have just any kind of a handle on that if we're talking about purchasing hunting access rights on private property? How much, if we have so much state property, sort of what access availability is there for hunting activity now that people don't have to pay for and the Game and Fish Fund wouldn't have to pay for?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I don't know that. I mean, the state owns a lot of land, not all of it, certainly most of it not purchased from private landowners, but there's certainly a lot of, you know, it's in the 5 million acre range of state land with forestry land and WMA land and SNAs and things like that. So
is all of that available for hunting?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, certainly almost all of it is. And I could get you the exact numbers.
That's
that.
Close. Thank you.
Well, the follow-up question to that would be then, of the rest of the acres, how much of that acreage is school trust land? I think we all have to understand this pretty well because it's a question that is
now. And Madam Chair, I know there's been a trust fund work group in the department looking at this issue, and we're aware of the types of questions that you're raising, and I have not been a part of that group, and I don't have a good handle on the total trust fund issue within the department. That might be another good item for discussion. I'm not prepared to give you those numbers today.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I guess, you know, I'm afraid that we're going to get to the end of the time before I get to ask this question, so I'm just going to barge in and ask it. Regarding the citizen oversight subcommittees, and I didn't realize till I sat at the DNR roundtable with some members of the budget oversight committees that we had this, what I call a really good resource, because these are the citizens out there that understand what hunters are thinking and doing. It's not legislators, and it's not people who work for the DNR or the state. And I just think that this is such a good use of our citizens that I was just wondering regarding this hunting access question that we're asked to look at this year. Did it come from the Budget Oversight Committee?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, they're certainly aware of it. There was a roundtable, as you were referencing, sitting with some of the Budget Oversight Committee, a roundtable. There was a roundtable a few years ago where walk-in access was a big focus of that roundtable, and there was general support for the concept of a walk-in program and for trying to do something like that in Minnesota. We did a report to the legislature, actually, like the following year. It was in January of 2008. We can provide the link to that. It's on the website. In that report, we surveyed other states that had walk-in programs, and the results of that were that walk-in programs in the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, Montana, places like that seemed to work very well. To the east of us, they didn't seem to work so well. They were more expensive. They tended to get preempted by private leases and things like that. So the kind of the couldn't really conclude the viability of a walk-in program for Minnesota. It seems like we're kind of on the bubble between where it works well and where it doesn't work so well. So there was support for the concept, but with the caveat that it not detract from acquisition and management of wildlife management areas. They did not want to see a walk-in program detract from the very successful wildlife management area system that we have in the state. You know, since that time, the Board of Water and Soil Resources and DNR have formed a work group and then worked with some of the interests on the Senate on what a pilot program for walk-in would require, and that's, I know, the subject of the bill here in the House as well, and came up with some ideas for basically doing a trial program to see if it would work here. But I think there's general support for it if it doesn't detract from the wildlife management area program.
And as a follow-up, thank you, Ms. Chair, and I'm wondering if the Budgetary Oversight Committee has recommended that, and I'm assuming they meet as a group occasionally, and I'm wondering if they have recommended, since they've already recommended that solutions come in the form of revenue enhancements and adjustments, I'm wondering if they've also recommended that that revenue would be used for a walk-in access program.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I'm not aware that they've made any specific recommendations. There's sort of an annual cycle of the Budget Oversight Committee, and they just had their first meeting of this current cycle a little bit late here for this cycle, but within the last couple of weeks. And I wasn't able to be at that meeting, but I don't believe they've taken a position on walk-in programs specifically.
Ms. Chair, and I'm just wondering if there's someone here from the Budget Oversight Committee that would be able to tell us if they discuss this and how they feel about using the Game and Fish Fund. And I guess I'm coming from somebody who buys a game and fish license, so I'm pretty protective of what I buy with my money, because I assume the DNR is just using this for things that are going to affect my activities as a holder of a game and a fish license. So I'm just kind of wondering if the Budget Oversight Committee, who I trust is looking over this fund, what they feel about using this for walk-in access program that may not affect, that may not enhance my experiences.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I'm not sure what they would recommend. They obviously also have the broader kind of fiduciary responsibility for looking at the Game and Fish Fund, and I know their big focus over the next year is going to be looking at the health of the fund and the need for perhaps fee increases for hunting and angling. But in reference to the imbalance that Mr. Squira talked about, where, you know, the wildlife expenditures are not keeping pace with wildlife revenues, and fishing revenues are exceeding fisheries, or fisheries expenditures are exceeding fisheries revenues, you know, one of the ways to create more of a balance there would be to increase wildlife expenditures, which a walk-in program would do. But I don't know specifically if that would be their first priority for increasing wildlife expenditures, or if they would even support increasing any expenditures given the status of the fund. I can't speak for them. Joe Dugan was recently appointed. Mr. Squira reviewed the structure of those committees. The chair of the overall committee is appointed by the commissioner, and then it consists of the various subcommittee chairs. And so Mr. Dugan is the new chair, and he's not here, but he'd be someone that, you know, maybe the committee could consult.
Ms. Chair, and Mr. Bogus, I think maybe we need to get a report from those, from that group, all of those, or the chair of the groups as they meet as a as an entire board. I just think that if that's their responsibility, I don't know why we haven't heard from them or why we haven't had a report from them. And is there such a report? And could the people, especially in charge of the, well, I guess there's so many different parts there, but I think that they need to weigh in on this, because I trust their judgment. I've spoken to a number of those people, and I just trust their judgment. Would like to hear from them.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, they do an annual report on, you know, they review this report and give their own report and recommendations, and those are also available on our website. But I don't believe that they have specifically weighed in on the walk-in issue. So I think we'd have to ask that question directly of that committee and get their recommendation.
And I'm wondering what the process, Mr. Chair, would be to ask them for a recommendation. Would that be coming from you or coming from us, or how would that happen mechanically?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, we could certainly bring that question back from this committee to that group. I think they meet monthly now. Their report normally comes out in June, but we could ask them if they wanted to make a recommendation specific to this issue. I think their next meeting is in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Oh, next Tuesday, Mr. Squira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of different varieties and questions. There's many of us around the table that serve on the Cultural Heritage Committee also, and we're 33% of that budget goes towards acquiring and buying lands essentially around the state and different things for hunting and fishing and that sort of thing. And I was just wondering if it'd be possible to get from you folks like a 10-year or some sort of graph or like a bar of, you know, that I can actually read. I'm having a hard time. I can think of any glasses to see what you've got. Presentation, but if you could do it like a graph, because I'm really curious about the future for Minnesota as we, because I think what's happening is your licenses are actually declining, is what I'm hearing, and we continue to acquire land, and so, and we're going to be spending money on 25 years of land acquisition, and we're having less and less hunters, and I'm just, it's just a really interesting philosophical debate. I mean, you know, at some point there's less hunters and we just keep buying stuff. So it's not that I'm against hunting, it's just, you know, how much access. It's a little what she's asking and those sort of things. So that's one question, if you could provide that, a graph, if you will, of the last few years, and then...
Of
the hunters and turkey hunters.
How many licenses or how many licensed hunters?
Okay. That sort of thing. And then kind of a projection, maybe you could speculate what the future bears, or not bears, but, you know, will be. So that's one question. And then Recently, there was, I don't know where I saw it or where I read it or what, but there was some articles related to cost per, I think, deer hunter. And it was, you know, so what, how, Madam Chair, what is, how much does a deer license cost?
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, $25.
Okay. Madam Chair and Mr. Bogness?
Mike Bogness.
Okay, Mr. Bogness, thank you. So I understand that there's quite a few costs that are higher than that, than the actual fee related to, so it's not really covering the cost for deer hunting out there. Is that an accurate assessment or not? Seems like I've read some articles. You're probably more familiar with them than I am.
Madam Chair and Representative Lilly, actually, I need to correct myself. I think it's $26 for a deer license. But, yeah, I think the deer license fee is covering the cost of deer management, if that's your question. I think that some of the needs, the unmet needs, and I know bills are progressing in both houses to require a report on unmet needs for wildlife management area, habitat development, things like that. You know, certainly we need to identify what those needs are, but the earlier slide talked about the percentage of the Game and Fish Fund that comes from deer license revenue, and it's by far the bulk of the source of revenue right now. And we can provide a chart on the last 10 years of hunter numbers, but Minnesota actually is kind of bucking the national trend. Our numbers have been pretty stable. But with the demographics of the aging population and the what looks like lack of recruitment of younger people into hunting, we do anticipate it will drop off in the future.
Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. I had an opportunity to, you know, I'm new to this committee, so it's, you know, I'm, you know, trying to figure out all the WMAs and all these RIM different projects, and I was on a bike trip in western Minnesota the other day, and I came across a couple projects, and maybe you can kind of help real quickly explain. So, like Cluster Lake, I think, is a WMA, and it has a sign and has all these different sponsors, so Pheasants Forever, RIM, and DNR. So my question is, who's really funding all these? And then there's one that was Dalton Lake, and it had about 20 different sponsors, or a whole big long list: Candy Iowa County, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited. But it just went on and on and on. So who's paying for it really, or why is there 20 different sponsors, or what's going on there? But it looks like, I think it's successful, because I saw some dead turkey heads, kind of, or not turkey, pheasant heads, kind of around. So something's getting shot out there, I'm guessing. I don't know if it's in season, but there's some evidence of success for hunters.
Madam Chair and Representative Lilly, there's a lot of these. I mean, these WMAs are very popular, and we get a lot of partners that want to help contribute to new acquisitions to WMAs or management of WMAs. And when we have significant sponsors or partners, you know, we'll dedicate that WMA and we'll list them on a sign for that WMA. So I'm not familiar with those specific WMAs that you just spoke about, but it sounds like they did involve multiple partners. You know, we have a lot of the Pheasants Forever and other deer hunters chapters raise money for WMA acquisition and management because they like those kinds of areas. So they're just very popular programs with those groups, and they're willing to partner in putting their money up to help purchase and manage those areas.
Representative Clark, did you have a question? I thought that we passed something where we had a reduced license fee for seniors and for young people. Am I wrong about that?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, there are reduced hunting license fees for youth under 18 and reduced small game license fees for people over 65.
It's just small game, Madam Chair?
And yes.
And is there evidence that the reduction of the fees has improved the recruitment, as you mentioned, of young people, or provided more use by seniors?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, we're doing a variety of things on the youth front, you know, so I don't know. We're seeing some, what looks like some improvement in youth participation, but it's hard to, there are confounding variables, and so it's hard to say that it's necessarily related to reduced fees.
I'd be interested, Madam Chairman, in just what you can tell us about that, I guess. I mean, I remember specifically that we made the change, so what's the impact, I guess, is the question.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll quickly try to go through the last few slides here. The history of the surcharge I talked about in 1957, the $1, it was changed to $2 in 1971, to $4 in 81, and to $6.50. 2003 legislature, effective in 2004. Moving on to the next slide. This is a history of acquisition with small game surcharge since 1982. And you can see, you know, it's ranged from a few hundred acres to a few thousand acres per year over that time. And moving on to the next slide, I just want to kind of give the committee a visual of what the Save the Wetlands concept initially looked like. The whole focus was there was uncontrolled drainage of wetlands going on at that time, and the early wildlife managers recognized the value of wetlands for wildlife, and the Save the Wetlands was designed to acquire these wetlands basically preserve them for wildlife habitat. And at that time, this is fairly typical. This was one of the first WMAs acquired. It was acquired in 1953, and you can see the legal description was a meets and bounds boundary around the wetland itself, not even necessarily including the entire emergent fringe of the wetland. Since that time, one of the major focuses of our acquisition has been to acquire upland to go with the wetlands that were acquired in the early days of the acquisition program. And kind of going back to the origin of the WMAs, you know, a small percentage have been acquired in the agricultural parts of the state. The bulk of the acreage was from marginal or what were called wastelands that were attempted to be farmed that had gone tax forfeit that got transferred into the WMA system. Our acquisition from private landowners has focused on wetlands and grasslands with you know, obviously some scattering of acquisitions throughout the state, but there was a citizens group 10 years ago that made some recommendations, and their recommendations were in line with kind of the origin of our acquisition program, which was to focus a lot of the acquisition on prairie wetland complexes and to add to those wetlands that were initially acquired to Save the Wetlands program. So that was the end of our presentation, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, Madam Chair, we had a informational hearing last night in Chair Dill's committee on a proposal along these lines, and I'm wondering the DNR, I see the gentleman's here, I didn't know if we'd have a couple minutes to ask him a couple questions, and they gave us a handout. I'm not sure if the handout was from Representative Hackbart or from the DNR, but it was really, it included a lot of neat ideas about a pilot program potentially for a walk-in, and it incentivized for land that was better habitat, closer to WMA, and if you made a two-year commitment. And are you interested? I'm thinking that somebody may offer that as an amendment to a bill potentially either in this committee or on the floor. So I was just wondering if we were going to hear from the DNR about that specific proposal. I think Senator Chaudhry is the one that's really pushing it in the Senate.
Well, two things. One, we do not have, there has not been a bill that has passed through the policy committees here. So the normal procedure would be for sending the book to Game and Fish, to Environment Policy, and then to us. There is no active bill book-wise, so that's just, so nothing is met deadline here. So that's, but because there was the discussion that the Senate was going to try to do something in conference committee without anybody ever even discussing it, and discussing the financial implications, we decided to have just an informational hearing here. So people understood what was going on, the short-term ramifications financially, the long-term ramifications. So things are just open for discussion here. There's not a set outcome. It's more that I have heard very strong and very conflicting opinions on about 10 different sides, not two sides. So I thought it would be wise for us to just have a discussion. And that's what we're doing. So we've just had the little background, and now it's a time for discussion. But I did want, I'd asked Mr. Reinholz, I think before we have any kind of next step of discussion, I'd ask him just to look at the financials of raising $2 million and what it would cost, just to get people a background. So that's where we are right now.
Madam Chair, members, there are two items in your package that I had distributed in order to go over some possibilities for you on funding a walk-in. One is the report that Mr. Bogness mentioned that the DNR did in response to legislation requiring them to do that. The Access to Minnesota Outdoors Plan is a very good report on summary of what the situation is in different states on the walk-in program and their assessment of some of the costs and some of the elements that would be important in the program. I'm not going to go through that. If you're interested in being informed on it, I would recommend that you read that. The one piece that the chair just mentioned that I did put together at her request was one page. And I'm sorry, my name's not on that. I usually put my name on things. This was Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is the title at the top, Historical Licenses. I took this from a DNR spreadsheet, and probably looking at it now, I should take that off of there. That's, I put my name on it somewhere. But what I did, and this is looking at just putting a surcharge on certain licenses, the licenses listed here. And the way I approached it was the number of dollars mentioned was what would it take to have $2 million worth of revenue annually in funding it from license fees in some way. If you look at the Access to Minnesota Outdoors Plan, it has some information on other states. Most states use license money for their walk-in program. Two ways are the common ways. One is to put a surcharge on, and another way is to have a special tag that people would have to buy in order to access walk-in lands. The third way is to just use general license fees, similar to what I would say we do on the deer hunting right now. We have a license that is just a total license fee that then is dedicated places. What I put together is the idea of a surcharge on licenses, what it would take to raise $2 million. You can see at the bottom there's 858,948 licenses in these categories. So it would take $2.33 surcharge to raise $2 million annually. That's one way to go about it. The DNR estimates in their Minnesota Outdoors Plan, one of the other approaches is to require that people have a special tag, basically, in order to access these lands. They had, and it depends a lot on how much you're going to pay for per acre on the land. They estimated using just pheasant hunters, because it seems to be a lot of the emphasis is on pheasant hunting. In order to have, if they were going to pay, have a program that spent about $2 million a year, which would, it would take a tag of about $17, is what they estimate in here, for if every pheasant hunter bought that tag for access to those lands. So you can see the cost would vary greatly depending on who it was assessed on and how you do it. There's multiple ways to do it. So the some of the biggest questions would be in the surcharge, who would support it? And that would be a good question to come out of the roundtables. When the DNR looked at the Minnesota Outdoor Access Walk-In Plan, they, I think, took an emphasis on pheasant hunting, but with also deer hunters being interested, I think that's a question that needs to be answered. Would deer hunters be interested in a surcharge on their licenses to support a walk-in program? I'm not sure that we have enough information on that right now. I think the biggest support is from pheasant hunters. It seems to be where we've heard the most support coming from. So that's just one possibility, one way to raise that money. The big question that I don't know is on, and Mr. Bogness mentioned that himself, and not completely sure on how that would, how much we would be able to access for the walk-in program. South Dakota averages around $2 an acre. Minnesota land is considered, farm country is considerably different than South Dakota. The experience may not, it is likely would cost more than that, I think, is what most people would say, than $2 an acre to get access into the lands. But that is really, I think, one of the questions that the pilot program is intended to answer. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, members.
The other thing I'd like to know is if there's anybody in the audience who would just like to make a comment. This is not testimony on the bill, I'm not taking anything out of my language, but if there's anybody that would like to make a comment, we will have to take it. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union and looked at this issue for quite a while. And Farmers Union is opposed to a walk-in access program. We took the position several years ago when the report came out, actually. We met with Mr. Penning and one of our members that was with me is also here in the audience today, too. And our main concern, and when I traveled out in the country about this, is property rights is the main concern. So trespassing and how that plays out. You're talking about private property. Talked to a couple other farmers last night, too, or just wondering, you know, how it works and looking at some of the details. Representative Hackbar's bill, I know you're not discussing that. You're just taking general comments. But, you know, is a pilot program. And a lot of the details are actually going to be hammered out if the bill passes over the next year and the report will come back in February, where a lot of these concerns probably could be, you know, hammered out. And I think it's getting better. But, for example, we had a really late corn harvest this last year. So in certain parts of the state, the farmer told me, you know, 50% of the land in Minnesota is rented. You know, it's not farmed by the owner. It's farmed or rented by, I don't know how that compares to the Dakotas. And so just saying, how does that work when I'm out there and the person who lives in the metro area or in town rents out the land, puts it in the plot program, and I'm out there trying to harvest my land. I'm sure there's a way that the other states do it, but that's a concern. How do we handle it when I live out there, my livestock, my kids, my family lives out there, my neighbor puts the land into this program, and people wander over, or I'm dealing with people, you know, just extra traffic and extra problems. And so you're talking about in your committee funding for the program. So we also want to make sure that we're talking about funding for administration of the program and enforcement of the program, so that when we have problems or we have issues, that would help make our members a lot more comfortable, I think. So, and just to remember, the other things we've heard is that we're a state of 5 million people compared to the Dakotas, and so I thought Commissioner Bogus did a good job of laying that out, that works good to the states the east of us, not as good to the, or works good to the states the west of us, not as good to the states the east of us. And then a couple other quick comments. Liability is something you'll hear about. There's a change that would need to be made. I feel comfortable if that was made that it'd work out okay. And I guess that's it. I'll just leave it at that. So.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone else like to make a comment? Members, any observations or comments? Representative?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that this was an informational hearing. It's supposed to be about the finance issues centered around this particular pilot project. And Mr. Reinholz, rather than maybe bringing the DNR back up, maybe you could I ask you, I think we talked about this briefly, how much money is on the bottom line in the Game and Fish Fund at this time?
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, the estimate is for the end of 2013 fiscal year to have $4.3 million balance.
But thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Reinholz, I thought when we talked for this budget, there was like $8 million on the bottom line.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, there actually is right now $10 million okay. Estimated at the end of 11, yes.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, to do this pilot program and ask for $2 million of that Game and Fish money, $10 million, which is on the bottom line, I don't think it's out of line or an unreasonable request to get this pilot project up and running. I don't think that there's any reason or need to talk about a surcharge or an additional fee on any licenses at this time to get a pilot project up and running. There is money available, and we can spend it on that. That's what it's available for. Doesn't affect the general fund. We can move forward with this and get this pilot project up and running. In the future, when we get these reports back and we look at whether this is a successful program or not, Mr. Peterson said, we can hammer out some of these minor details to make this thing work as far as liability and those kinds of things go. We can take care of and solve those problems. But I think this is an important issue that we should bring forward, and money is available. Doesn't affect the general fund. I think it's important that we move forward and make this thing happen. The money's available. I would not be opposed to putting a surcharge or some kind of a extra license fee or something in the future, should this be successful. But let's try it and see what it looks like. If you wanted to bring the DNR up and talk about what they have come up with for a plan to make this pilot project work. We had that discussion last night in Representative Dill's committee, so maybe we don't need to do it today unless other folks want it to happen, but we can do that. But it's just a pilot program to see if it's going to work. I think that's where we're at now, and I think it's an important thing to do. And I think the DNR and the different groups that came together to put this plan together came up with a good solution. That's why we've got this pilot program built here today. But I think some of the statements that were made about school trust on land, and I mean all those things are different issues, not necessarily connected with this pilot program.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, around here everything's interconnected, I think. And one of the things that we will have to discuss as a committee, not this year but next year, is dealing with the school trust lands. There's no question in my mind. The push for that is heavy, and I don't think that we can say that we have done the best we can do as from a fiduciary point of view of putting money into that fund. We are going to see if we can get some work done over the interim so that all of us understand that issue better. And when I mean all of us, I mean all of us in the Education Committee and all of us in this committee, because there are folks who think there's $1 billion to be had. I think that's nonsense. But I think we're all better off if we deal straight with the facts on the table and really good, hard numbers, which one of the other things that I'm hoping that Mr. Bogus will be doing, I trust he will be doing over the interim, is we have a lot of WMAs that are in what is called minimal condition. Well, the question I have is, what if they were in good condition and were they were healthy and would attract a lot more wildlife, a lot more bugs that the pheasants would eat because you had just better vegetation? We haven't done any kind of weighing about the best way to spend money. And I mean, the science out there is very strong in saying that if lands are in really good shape, if the habitat is really good, then that's where the pheasants and the birds go. I mean, that's what happens. So we don't have to ask, we don't have to talk to the, we have to listen to the scientists, but we have to then talk about the finances here. And I don't think we've answered that question yet. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think the hard thing to understand here is why we're doing this irrespective of deadlines. I mean, I had a bunch of bills that didn't get hearings because I missed the deadline on a couple of them. And I'm thinking that if we're dealing with finances, this is the committee that would deal with finances. And I feel shortchanged that we're unable to have this bill before us because it definitely has financial implications. And the Budget Oversight Committee certainly should have been requested because it would have popped up on the web regarding this bill would be coming to finance, and everybody would have known that it was coming here. An informational hearing does not bring the people to come to a hearing that should be here, and I think, you know, I think it's something that we should be talking about next year and run it through the deadlines the way everybody else has to do it, and I think that that's the way we should do it. I did have one question, though, for the DNR related to these other communities, these other states that have the walk-in access program. The one thing I don't understand is how many state-owned acres of hunting availability are in those states. If we have 5 million, I guess I'm not sure if North Dakota is such a large landowner like Minnesota is. I think that's something that maybe could be fleshed out, and we could, and if you know that, you can tell us. I'm just kind of curious because I was always told that Minnesota was one of the states that the state owned such a large percentage of property, and I'm not sure if that's accurate or not.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I would have to get back to you. It is true that Minnesota is one of the leading states in terms of state-owned land, but the Dakotas have a lot of federal land, more so than what we do. So in terms of public land available for hunting, I'm not sure. And I don't know if Mr. Penning is here, if he knows the answer to that question. Otherwise, Bill Penning is our farmland wildlife program leader and worked on the walk-in access report.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, what Mr. Bogus said is true. Minnesota does have more state-owned land than most of the other states that have walk-in programs. However, many of those states have vast ownerships of federal land that are open to hunters. For instance, there's a lot of BLM land and U.S. Forest Service land in the western states that are open. But part of the issue that we have here in Minnesota is that most of our public land is in the northern forested part of the state, and the demand for the walk-in program
is in the agricultural part of the state. Our state and federal ownerships in the agricultural portion of the state are relatively small compared to the forested part of the state, and also small in comparison to what other states own in their agricultural part. So really, when we're talking about a walk-in program in Minnesota, we're talking about access to agricultural land for hunting.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reinholz talked about this program that the DNR, about a potential $2 million for the pilot in southwestern Minnesota. But, Mr. Pennington, didn't you say last night that potentially there could be some federal match available? I know Chairman Peterson, when he spoke at the MOHA banquet, talked about millions of dollars of federal money that Minnesota was not accessing. If I remember right, aren't we potentially, that cost of $2 million would be less to the state?
Potentially, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, that is true, potentially. The last federal farm bill had $50 million in it for a program called Open Fields, which is a walk-in access program. It's going to be targeted at states that already have a walk-in access program. There are between 22 and 17 states right now that have a walk-in program, so there will be some competition for that money. The money is sitting there. It'll be doled out over the next 3 years, $17 million a year for the first 2 years and $16 for the second. However, the federal rule has not yet been written, so we don't know what our access would be to that money or what our requirements for match or anything like that would be. However, I would think that we would have a very good chance at getting some of that money and offsetting some of our costs.
But at this point, the rules have not been written.
Correct.
That was my understanding too. Representative McNamara.
Well, and I think that's a good point, Madam Chair, that potentially if we didn't qualify, it would cost $2 million. And if we did qualify, if it was a 50% match, it might be $1 million. So as Mr. Reinholz said, in 2013, we potentially wouldn't have $4 million. If we used all the game and fish money, we'd only have maybe three or four. We'd have only $2 or $3 million instead of four then, or the $10 million we have now would be reduced by $1 or $2 million. The only thing I would say, Madam Chair, is the folks that are using this land and buying hunting licenses are generally like this idea of a surcharge in the future. And if we had a pilot program to step forward, I think that's a more logical first step, that we do it as a pilot, because there are things to learn. And I just, in my experience with walk-ins, this layout that I'm sure Mr. Pennington was involved in, it laying out to where you would only have it for grasslands. I think Mr. Peterson's thought, I'm sorry, but in some of South Dakota, when you have a walk-in that's a picked cornfield, it's not any good, and why pay for that? It should be native prairie grasslands. Being close to existing other public hunting access is great. There's an incentive in your program for that. Large tracts, naturally a full section is better than 880s as far as public hunting opportunities and holding the game and such. And then long-term commitment. And I just think the way you laid it out, I know it's not before us that, but that kind of an idea, I think hunters would be ready for it. And to Mr. Reinholz's point, I think it would be inappropriate to charge the deer hunters. I think it's a small game. You could potentially say turkey hunters, but this would need to be either the new dedicated money or a surcharge on small game, potentially turkey, sportsman combination, stuff like that. But mostly in the area we're talking about, in the agricultural southwestern part of Minnesota, I mean, deer hunters would benefit, but it would be hard to charge short of just doing it in the four season or the zone four or something. But I think that might be more problematic. But I would say duck hunters, clearly, this grassland has sloughs in it that would be duck hunters would benefit too, and naturally all the small game rabbits and such too.
Of course, you took out the deer, the fees would rise substantially. I mean, everyone that comes out. And that is, of course, part of what is a normal finance committee's discussion. And the reason that I do believe that a bill like this should come through this committee and be voted on by these members, because there's another issue outstanding here that you know, you've got to put everything on the table, and that is that we did cut DNR substantially this year, and I suspect in the next budget, some of the money that's sitting on the table right now may have a higher priority than this, and we haven't discussed that issue. It may be that, I mean, we don't know that there might not be something that's far higher priority because of the cuts. Representative Doty is next. And then Representative Perkelson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any information from the other states that have some sort of walk-in programs on what percentage of the people that use this are their own citizens? And would you comment on what you would see here in Minnesota as a, you know, our own citizens' use compared to people coming in from other states if we would do such a program?
Madam Chair, representatives, we don't have hard numbers on that. It varies substantially from state to state. Clearly, North and South Dakota have a large proportion of non-residents that hunt there. In Minnesota, I think it would be primarily our own residents that would be hunting on these lands. The way that the Dakotas tend to do it is they tend to have a surcharge on each license that's sold, and I believe it's $13 in South Dakota, and they don't report that their hunters are balking at that.
It's 10 o'clock, and I'm going to ask Representative Purcell.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move approval of the minutes April 8th,
2010. Has moved the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. The meeting is adjourned.